Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan Natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
The Northwest Community College, word of the day, in English, is honey bucket.
In Yupik, hun.
In Siberian, Yupik, kushuk.
In Inupiaq, anarvik.
Honey bucket.
Hun.
Kushuk.
Anarvik.
Honey bucket.
Hun.
Kushuk.
Anarvik.
Presented as a public service of the Northwest Community College, honey bucket.
Hun.
Kushuk.
Anarvik.
The word for today on this edition of Chinook is eavesdrop. I'm Paula Schiller, and we'll be listening in on station KNOM in Nome. They've given us some random samples of features, public service announcements, and inspirational spots that show what they're doing to reach out to the Native community. KNOM's signal can be picked up from Point Hope to the Aleutians, and it reaches hundreds of miles into Siberia. But KNOM doesn't care to beam propaganda to the Soviet Union. Its stated goal is to serve Western Alaska's Native population. And while KNOM is owned by the Catholic Diocese of Northern Alaska, it doesn't go in for heavy-handed religious programming either. They call it the soft sell approach. Let's take a listen.
To do something worthwhile once is like anyone else.
To do something worthwhile twice is different.
To do something worthwhile for a week or two, that's pretty good.
But to do something worthwhile, like the jobs at home, or at work, or at school, day after day, month after month, year after year, that takes, if you'll pardon the expression, guts.
Munns Northern Airlines Village Report.
I'm Savunga at the first grade class, and today there's going to be another language class going on. And can you explain what the kids will be learning today?
Abby has the beginners for their alphabet class, and she teaches the basic sound of the Yupik alphabet. Then she expands onto pictures that start with that sound, writing the letter. And then they learn to pronounce the sound. They can give examples of words that start with that sound. They learn to read it and write it.
And now we are with Abby Sepulu, and she has about 12 children here, and they're going to be doing the alphabet?
Yupik alphabet, yeah.
And how are you going to teach this?
I'll just have them say what the letters are and how they sound. And maybe they can say some words that begin with the letters.
Go right ahead. And that's a look at how language is taught here at the first grade class of the Savunga Day School. And now we're going to say goodbye. For KNOM, this is Tom Sofio in Savunga.
KNOM takes another new look at the news.
Today, a new look at Sinew. We visited Mary McToyuk here in Nome, and with her son, John Ayuk, we talked about the preparation of Sinew for sewing. Mary's braiding sinew into twine for sewing a skin boat, a boat John says one of his cousins will make this year. John says his mother's been using sinew for sewing since she was a girl.
My grandmother teach her how to do that. It comes from mother to mother, and even before the outboard motors came.
Mary explained where sinew comes from and how it is prepared.
Mom, can you back and legs of the caribou or reindeer. We also get it from wars back. Wars are even stronger than caribou or reindeer.
For the skin boat, twine, caribou sinew, and walrus sinew are braided tightly into 10 to 12 foot long cords. Each strand of the braid is made of short strands, wet and twisted together. The braided cord of sinew has finely pointed ends to fit through the eye of the needle easily. The result is a strong thread, strong enough for a skin boat.
The last time she made a thread like that, it went to Frank Elan's boat. That was 2 years ago.
Although many women now use commercial thread and dental floss for skin sewing, others retain the old ways. For Mary McToyuk and the hunters who use her thread for their boats, the ability to make sinew into thread is valuable still.
Now it's time for the KNOM Village Report. For Village News, this is Tom Bush. From the Nome Nugget, an article by Steve Kirschbaum, Gamble Carvers Hone Their Skills on Whalebone. Carving is a way of life in Gamble, the largest village on St. Lawrence Island. For most families, it is the only source of income. Young carvers learn from their fathers and village elders like Frank Octokayak. They learn by watching and carving whalebone before graduating to ivory. Clement Ungott, an experienced carver, begins with a walrus tusk that has aged a minimum of 2 months. He knows ivory must be thoroughly dried to prevent it from cracking. Rough shaping is done freehand with a handheld electric grinder. Sharp edges are rounded with files, then scraped for delineation with a small chisel. The ivory is then sanded smooth and buffed to a rich luster. Hunting walrus for food and ivory is risky business. In the fall, hunting is limited by weather and available light. Spring hunting is overshadowed by the threat of sudden snowstorms and shifting ice. When a walrus is sighted, a skilled marksman aims for the hump at the base of the neck, a quick, clean kill. He's well aware that a wounded walrus could attack a skin boat and spill the hunters into the frigid Bering Sea. When walrus migrate past St. Lawrence Island, Jerry Tungian hunts with his brothers and sons. All were taught never to waste meat, so kills are limited. The men hunt from a skin boat or umiak, not so much out of tradition, but because a good umiak holds far more than a wood or aluminum boat of like size. When a walrus is taken, the meat is dried for future meals, and the ivory is divided amongst the hunters.
The Northwest Community College word of the day in English is ice.
Inupiaq tsikuq.
In Siberian, Inupiaq tsikuq.
In Inupiaq tsikuq.
Ice.
Tsikuq.
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 Ice.
Tsikuq.
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 Presented as a public service of the Northwest Community College.
Tsikuq.
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 Ice.
Daniel Iacatan Sr. is retired from hunting. As captain of a skin boat, he still receives his share of meat and ivory, but leaves the hunting of walrus to his younger brothers.
Fossil, Daniel prefers fossil ivory when carving. Fossil ivory is scraps of walrus tusk buried in berms, marking locations of two previous Gamble village sites. Daniel's wife digs through the berms almost daily. She searches for ivory that resembles chunks of broken tree root. It is back-breaking work, hours with pick and shovel. But fossil ivory, which has been slowly aged, is easier to carve and brings a better price from buyers. We're listening to an article, Gamble Carvers Hone Their Skills on Whalebone, by Steve Kirschbaum, reprinted in the Nome Nugget. If you have news of your village, won't you write us? We sure would like to hear from you. Just a card or a letter and share what's happening with all of Western Alaska. How's the fishing going? Who's new in town? Who's left town? That kind of thing. Village News, KNOM, Box 988, Nome. Thanks. For Village News, this is Tom Bush.
Yours for Western Alaska. This is KNOM, Nome.
The word, day in and day out at KNOM, is positive, and they call their programming people-oriented, perhaps because the kinds of features we've been listening to are the products of volunteer labor and dedication. Aside from director Father Jim Poole and the station manager who receives a salary, the staff is made up of volunteers, some who work at the station and some nurses in Nome who donate their entire paychecks to KNOM operations. In turn, the volunteers get room and board and $10 a week pocket money. They sign up for a year, but many stay much longer. Father Poole, who virtually founded the station, began working on the project in the early 60s. He got the station on the air in 1971. Here is Father Poole reading from the book, People of Koerik.
Epilogue. Memories of William Aquilic continued. There are two mountains at the west end of Amurrik Basin that have driftwood up near the top and lots of clamshells on them. They show where the flood came. They are those two peaks between Tissue and Fither rivers, and they call them Sinitu. There's some hot springs up by Serpentine. Our people had a story about that place. If you put your muckluck strings in that hot water and they curled all up and were ruined, that meant you were going to die soon. I don't know about that, but Carl Kafanuk and I went up there once a long time ago, and we put our muckluck strings in that hot water, and Carl's muckluck strings all curled up. They were ruined. Mine stayed just like new. 2 months later, Carl came down from Kusatrine River. Something happened. He drowned. I know I'm still alive. I still get to see this old country. In the old days, they did not bury people close together like the white man's graveyard. It's hard to find the graves now because the reindeer grazed all over that country. Whenever somebody died, they buried them right there as long as it was dry and high so the water wouldn't destroy them or anything like that. Sometimes they had to take the dead person a little ways to find a good place enough to bury him. They didn't dig in the ground to hide them. They put them on tripods. There's one good illustration down on the beach where Napa's grave is. She was so old when she died down between Point Douglas and Point Woolley, they built a big tripod of beechwood. It is still standing out there. You can see it when you go down with the dog team out on the ice because it stands up high. It's a bad place in the evening because when you go to pass it,
The People of Koerik by William Aquilic. Edited by Laurel Bland. The People of Koerik, Fridays, 10:30 a.m. and p.m. on KNOM.
We thank KNOM for sharing these segments with us, and we hope we can listen in on some other Bush stations on Chinook. I'm Paula Schiller, and Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaska Natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
This little outfit here is starting to snowball. You know, it's picking up momentum. It's got a good track record as far as what it's accomplished. And it's supporting some very worthwhile workshops. I've dealt with it on the board as a board member and also as a professional artist. And so I can see they are hitting, you know, I like to keep focus on grassroots, and they're addressing that. Because, you know, you realize, you know, in getting bureaucracy and stuff, you know, people can start talking in the clouds and get all these systems going, but forget the focus. You know, you got to focus in on the beach rocks and the beach grass. I mean, that's where it's all at.
That was artist Alvin Amason. The little outfit he referred to is IANA, the Institute of Alaska Native Arts. Amason was in Fairbanks earlier in the year to attend a board meeting. He is also on the Native Arts Committee of the State Council on the Arts. And he's right about IANA's growth. It's steadily raising its profile by sponsoring workshops, conferences, assisting artists, and by producing radio and television programs, all being coordinated by Executive Director Karen McPherson. At a crowded reception at the IANA office in Fairbanks, Ellen Hayes, another board member, took time out to talk about the purpose of IANA.
What I think it is to advocate and to encourage Alaska Native art. And the way we do it is through programs that are applied for and that we study and to see if it goes where we want it to go. So it does indeed support that effort. It's not an institute of physical dimensions with plumbing and electricity and all those things, heat and rooms and walls, but it's a program, and its purpose is decided by its constitution, and that is that we would be advocates, not only for the artists and Alaska Native art, but for the general public, to acquaint the two with that value that's their real heritage, and to keep it going contemporarily in our contemporary times. So that's what I see it as.
That leads me to the question of, though, can you define Alaska Native art then? Because you run into problems, I guess, with traditional craft kinds of things, and then you get to the contemporary art, which may or may be done by natives, but doesn't have that, you know, traditional stamp on it.
Mm-hmm.
How does the board, or how does IANA deal with that division?
We've dealt with programs so far that have dealt with the various ethnographic groups in basketry. The one common denominator would be basketry. We've dealt with programs at the university here in workshops that would deal with wood as a medium and the forms it would take naturally. And that doesn't necessarily mean Alaska Native tradition, but the forms of wood itself. And then the artists and craftsmen, whoever, whatever they might be called, could get their ideas from the normal things that can be done with wood. And their own ethnographic heritage would dictate to them what they therefore think, you know, they could use. So no, we haven't separated the two because it isn't that clear even to us. And we're not old enough to say, based on our experience of the last 4 or 5 years, this is what we have defined it to be. Since we're only a couple of years old, it isn't that clear to us either. So we're just going to have to deal with it as it comes along. Do you have any ideas of what do you think it is?
Well, I'm wondering, is it any kind of art that's done by natives? Is that native art? Or does it have to have something of the tradition in it? And if it's any kind of art that's done by natives, why do you need the Institute of Alaska Native Arts? Why don't you just teach art in the public schools, or, you know, why can't it be anybody's art?
That's what we were considering today. There, we recognize only today from the work that Alvin Amason is doing, going out to rural communities on special grant programs, that there is a real thirst in the rural schools for expressions in the arts. And they're primarily Native, but they're not all Native. And he said that with his coming there in mask making art, that there was a real interest with Alaska Native people, well, in Bush schools, which are primarily Alaska Native, but not totally, in the arts. And we recognize from that there needs to be an arts element in the school program and to balance off the sports. In some schools, there's swimming and basketball and wrestling, but there isn't this other. And what Alvin said was he recognizes the thirst of the young people to express themselves, to get into their own expression and interpret it. So maybe our role isn't Alaska Native necessarily, because we are working with the Alaska State Council of the Arts, but our emphasis is to include the ethnic history in art and its expressions, and how people work with it individually is their own creation. But we want them to acquaint themselves. So often in American Indian, in American life, the Indian history has been excluded. So what we're trying to do is include it and to encourage it and to advocate for it.
Ayana board member Ellen Hayes. And turning again to Alvin Amison, he's an Aleut by ancestry and an artist by profession. He too addresses the question of what makes Native art Native.
Well, I would have to be honest and say I consider myself an artist first. I'm already Native. I don't have to follow any kind of designs to produce Native art. I happen to come from a nation that their visual images are pretty well gone. And if you want to see them, you got to go to D.C. and go to the Smithsonian, our very private collections. So I was not inhibited by a rich history of what our people had done a long time ago. So I'm Western educated. I've been outside. I'm very aware of contemporary trends. I compete in that market. It's the secondary that I'm a Native. Although being Native and raising that lifestyle has sincerely affected my work. It's like a diary of my life. But I've had a lot of students. I've worked in Navajo Res for a couple of years and saw how they were inhibited. A lot of them were inhibited by past designs and things that no longer had any meaning to them, you know, but they thought it was cultural, and therefore they had to paint this way or deal with these designs. They didn't know anything really about. It's really sad to see. Culture is something, it's got to be living. It can't be put up in formaldehyde on a shelf. The culture is a living thing. And to me, when you talk about cultural elements and things like that that affect people, to me something's really important is the outboard motor. It's had a hell of an impact on people all over the state. To me, that's the cultural element now. And I'll address it probably in my next painting. Does that answer your question?
Well, the problem is a little bit about what, like something like called the Institute of Native Arts, which is to promote, part of its existence is to promote awareness of Native art. Mm-hmm. But are they promoting the traditional basket, the beadwork? Or where does something like contemporary painting, contemporary literature, something like that fit in to the scheme of something that would fall under the Institute of Alaska Native Arts?
I think judging on the programs we have been involved in, and even the workshops I've just come from, they're both being addressed. I think sometimes it's dangerous to try to separate and label things. I just was involved in a workshop on the Yukon Kuskokwim, and I was working side by side with a poet. And these little kids are writing poetry, very excited about it. And I was doing, we were making a kind of story masks, very contemporary masks. I mean, they made masks about snow machines, things that affected their daily life, you know. And on the other hand, their mothers are bead workers, are still involved, what I call a classic Native arts. I think that this institute right here is addressing them both. You know,
The traditional arts like the beadwork, the carving, and traditional forms are definitely Native art.
Right.
Right. but the kind of thing that would be contemporary art, just teaching art, teaching a workshop in painting or teaching poetry, could be anybody's art program. It doesn't have to, you know, there's nothing really native about it, except that it's maybe going directly to natives. Do you see a problem? It's like attaching native to the output of Western art doesn't seem to do anything either for the art or for the people that are producing it.
I'd have to disagree with you there, because I am in that category. I was not inhibited by a classic period, because I wasn't, although my grandmother is a basket weaver in a classical sense, a native sense, I was not visually inhibited. Therefore, I had to rely on a Western education. However, what I work with and what I dress are things that I was raised with. Our visual images might be gone, but our diet's the same. Our trapping's the same. We still hunt the same way. We still have the same weather we had 100 years ago. We still have our same... it's more important to us to rather than have $1,000 in checking accounts to make sure you got all your fish in for smoking, because we really kind of need that stuff. I treat those address those things in a Western fashion, because that's the training I've had. And I think what's important about an institute such as this, or getting into the Native Arts Committee of the State Council, is you have people that have been experienced in these life ways, are aware of contemporary trends and education, and can communicate with the kids being raised today, you know.
Are those IANA working on programs that could help other people that may have talent in art, or are interested in art and are trying to feel their way through working in a traditional classical manner or working in more a contemporary style? What is the sort of, is there a mission of IANA to help them through these things?
I think it's a pilot pusher. Like to push pilots. Create a stimulus and hope that wherever that endeavor was taken into, for instance, the Iditarod School District, where they just had quite a bit of money pumped in there, hope they take that inertia and interest and energy that was developed and run with it. Don't keep coming back. We're trying to address something that's needed there. We see it. We identified it. And here's some money, and we're going to bring in these people and let's get this thing going. And hopefully their eyes will open up and carry on with it. It's, I'm not only picking on Iditarod, I just came from there, but I did one in Kodiak also. And it'd be just wonderful for these school systems they're really not addressing the arts. I couldn't talk about this area, but I can talk about the ones I've been in three workshops just this spring, in the last month, I think. And I've seen the same thing. You got a central population area, and then you've got a whole bunch of bush schools. They could keep one very good artist busy all year just doing little things, flying each village, you know. If you can see, like, that lady there, Catherine McNamara, who set together this Iditarod thing, and works the poetry with the kids, and when she goes to a village like Holy Cross, you got little kids running down the hall, stuffing papers in her hands, poems they've been working on while she's been gone. And those kids, if they had some kind of follow-up, and they're little ones, you think of the concepts and the mind-stretching things that they're involved in, at that level, if that has a follow-up, they're going to be pretty sharp turkeys, you know, in a few years, you know, because you know you develop a discipline and interest, that kind of inertia and quality will carry over into other disciplines. You know, and I really don't think that the state at large in the educational systems, from what I've seen, is addressing it and don't realize the importance of it. I think we're just flying around too many basketball players, and I like basketball, but there's just too many bucks being pumped in other things.
Alvin Amison at the Institute of Alaska Native Art. We also heard from IANA board member Ellen Hayes. I'm Paula Schiller. You've been listening to Chinook, a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.